do we heal these big rifts in our systems?
I went in with my eyes wide open, ready to learn and listen.
There's no co-designing without co-deciding.
All of these difficult questions are polarities, two options where choosing one or the other is always a mistake.
There is more movement than I think people can see.
Our elders enable us to see further.
Wherever we are in an organisation, we do have the power to contribute to some change.
Kia ora and welcome to episode 68 of Beyond Consultation. Very pleased to have you here as we continue to explore this kaupapa of how can your organisation better serve community needs. Today's episode for me almost starts 5 years ago because recently a notification popped up on my phone from Google Photos. It does these things where it goes, "Do you remember this day 5 years ago?" And the day was this youth and community hui that I had facilitated. And it looked like a great hui in the photos, but the story that isn't told in the photos is the day beforehand when I couldn't get out of bed. The alarm went off, I had all this work to do to get ready for the hui, and I had piled on this immense made-up pressure for the hui to be a certain way and to achieve certain things in the world, and it was too much, and I couldn't get out of bed. And I didn't realise at the time that I was burning out. I went and saw a GP, and I remember, you know, asking, like, why am I crying? What's going on? They asked me good questions. They got me exercising again. And not long after, I stopped working three jobs. I went down to just two and then just one. And then the real circuit breaker actually was having our daughter. But anyway, all of that is to say that a lot of the reasons for me starting this podcast was in part to understand experiences like that where I felt completely unsure about my role in trying to enable good stuff to happen in between that space of government, community, business, iwi, personal, professional world that sometimes we find ourselves sitting in. From my own self-development and work over the last 4 or 5 years, I've come to realize that part of what was going on for me was the beliefs that I was coming into my work with. And one of those really goes to the heart of what this show is about. Today's show was organized quite spontaneously, well, as far as podcast interviews go, because usually it takes about 6 months from, hey, would you like to be a guest, to us actually publishing this thing. But I bumped into Megan Courtney from Inspiring Communities, and she shared a draft report with me called Make the Move: Shifting How the Public Sector Works with Communities. I read through it, and I just thought, wow, if I was to compile Beyond Consultation into a report, this is basically the report that I would hope it would become. And so today on the show, we have the report's author, Sarah Morris. She's a freelance social and systems change consultant. She's also, amongst many other things, co-chair of Huie, Community Aotearoa. And I called her the report author, but she's almost more like a curator, because this report channels the voices of 20 change makers from around Aotearoa, New Zealand. And some people kind of cringe at that word change maker. I do sometimes as well, but I think it's the right word here. Some of these people have been on the show before, actually. Some are from within government, some in community organizations, some in iwi organizations, and the report channels their voices. And we're lucky to have also one of them on the show too, Vanessa Sydney Richmond of Te Aitanga a Mahaki in Taranaki. She's the Pohu Whiranaki of Te Tihi o Ruahine Whānau Ora Alliance. And so she's really able in the interview to share her unique perspective of what's it like being in an iwi organisation and trying to change that relationship that you might have with government agencies. There's a couple of things that I loved about the report and why I was so keen to share through a different medium what the report is shining a light on. The overall message behind the report is to say, hey, if you're working in government, your role is not just about creating solutions. Actually, it's about creating conditions for communities, for other people to be able to do the kind of mahi that they need for themselves. So the report's organized around four key insights, and we kind of jump randomly between them because, yeah, we can. So those four conditions are creating the conditions for Te Ao Māori-led change, the conditions for government to be facilitators and enablers, the conditions for ethical and trusting relationships, and the conditions for innovation, learning, and adaptability. And coming back to my story from the start of this show, where I was just piling on the pressure on myself, part of what was going on for me was this belief that it was my role to create solutions and be responsible for devising, managing, delivering, and implementing those in partnership with others, yes, but I put a lot of weight on myself. And actually, as people looking to enable change, we are shaped by our environment. And so we have to pay attention to our environment, to the conditions that are going to make it easy or hard for us to achieve the kind of outcomes that we're looking for. I love that the report is really written with a very clear audience in mind. And it's the same audience as who listens to this show. And what I love about it is there are some prompting questions in there, along with some suggested actions. And I really think this is a report that requires you to learn by doing, not just learning by reading or learning by listening. So take it and turn it into a learning experience for you and your team. And I hope this episode today gives you the spark of inspiration to know that that's going to be worthwhile for you. So please welcome to the show Vanessa Sydney Richmond and Sarah Morris.
Oh, well, kia ora, Paul, Sarah, nama hea te kia kōrua. Ko ai, ki te tawa tōku pāpa, nō te aitanga maha ki arongo whakasa, ki te tawa tōku māma, hea uri anō nō Taranaki Maunga. Kia ora, Vanessa, Sydney Richmond, currently, or have for a little while, been living back in Papaiwea in Palmerston North, and work for an amazing organisation, Te Tihi Orohene Whanawara Lives.
Mm. Oh, kia ora, Vanessa. Well, I've spent a bit of time in Palmy North, when I worked in Wellington at the Ministry of Justice for a while, and they used to bus me up to the Palmy North courts, take notes for some meeting that I cannot remember anymore. But yeah, it's one of those places, reminds me a little bit of Hamilton, and that it gets a bad rap by people who haven't been there.
Very true.
Yeah. Hey, so thank you, Vanessa, for coming on the show. And then I'm going to pass it to you, Sarah.
Kia ora, Paul. Tēnā kōrua. Kowai au, he awa whiria ahau, no Ngāti Airini, me Ngāti Kōtirana, me Ngāti Pōrana, me Ngāpuhi oku tupuna. Ko Tamaki Makaurau te whenua tupu I te taha o Manukau Hotunui o te awa. Ko Sarah Morris toko ingoa. So I kind of identify as a braided river. So my ancestry is Irish, Scottish, Polish, yeah. Jewish, and Ngāpuhi. And I grew up in Tamaki Makaurau in the eastern suburbs in Pakuranga. And I am alongside the Manukau Harbour. So my name is Sarah. And I now live, while I'm talking to you here in Cairns, while I'm at a hui, I'm normally in Te Awa Kairangi in Lower Hutt is where I am with my husband and my two kids and my dog, but most of my family are still up in Tamaki in Auckland.
Well, kia ora, Sarah. Well, you sound like you're a braided river with your ancestry, maybe a bit of a braided river of where you live in. And from what I've seen, you're a bit of a braided river in terms of your career as well. You know, going into government, out, consulting.
Yeah, I feel a gravitational pull to in-between spaces. Whether that be culturally or otherwise, I'm not sure what that means. I kind of, you know, I feel like I'm always learning and kind of interested in different things and so get drawn into it. But I mean, I could talk about my professional stuff when you want me to, Paul, but I'll be guided by you.
I mean, usually I dive into that a little bit in the podcast, but with two of you on the show, I think we might almost just leave that there for the moment. And also because the context for this kōrero is around Make the Move report, which Inspiring Communities has just released. And the subtitle of that report, Shifting How the Public Sector Works with Communities. And I'm really keen to unpack this with you both. Sarah, can you maybe take us back to some of those first conversations where some good people are scratching their heads and going, we need to write about this?
Yeah, sure. And Vanessa, jump in, hey, because I did come in possibly a little bit late. So I'm a Powerdom associate, which is the consultancy arm of Inspiring Communities. So that's how I kind of came into this mahi. So the way I understand it is in 2020, Inspiring Communities wrote a report called Shaping the Future. And I think a lot of that was about the response of communities in COVID-19 times. And so they sort of recognized some different themes about community-led development from that, and they wrote stories about community experiences. And I guess in the 3 years from then to now, what they were hearing from communities more and more was, it's great, government, you know, public sector officials are really interested in this community-led development stuff. You know, they're wanting to honour Te Tiriti o Waitangi. You know, they're talking about consultation, co-design, and all of their strategy documents and visions and missions, and there's all these policies. But to be honest, we're not really feeling it on the ground. We're not feeling any change in behavior or change in the way that government is either funding or building relationships with us on the ground. And there's sort of, I guess, my understanding is that the inspiration for writing the report was a little bit from that frustration. Yeah. From what Inspiring Communities were hearing from communities who were tired and overworked and really wanting to see a change, and hearing a lot of kind of rhetoric and talk about it, but not really seeing that behavior change happening. And then at the same time, Inspiring Communities were also hearing from public policy workers who are tired and overworked and stuck in this kind of bureaucratic system where maybe they're wanting, you know, as individuals and members of their own communities to see change, but are feeling frustrated because they can't, they're sort of a bit trapped in the system, I suppose, and not being able to, even if they can see it, and maybe some of them can't, some of them can, but not being able to kind of operationalize that. So it was a little bit of Inspiring Communities kind of listening to these people, seeing the sort of system change aspect of it, wanting to understand that a little bit more and also help the public service essentially to make the move and to make those changes to better enable communities to lead their own
development. Okay. So I'm hearing from you this gap between the want, like there's this desire to work in a different way, to be more community led, but there's a gap between that and what's actually happening, and on multiple sides of that picture. So, and as you were talking, I'm nodding my head because I see and I hear that a lot. And Vanessa, I'm curious for you, you know, you're working with Te Tihi, so alongside or in the background with whānau, how was that experience for you of that challenge?
You know, and as an iwi Māori organisation, there's always another layer of challenge when engaging with our Te Tiriti partners. So, you know, that's another layer for us. I think we are quite an innovative and dynamic organization who has really tried really hard and I think been successful in trying to break through some of those barriers and not necessarily waiting for but approval from that central government space. But at the same time, you need to be a bit, you know, respectful of some of those processes that are in place in order to achieve the end game in that way. So I think, you know, we've been in existence probably about 8 years now, or 10, sorry.
Yeah.
So we've learned quite a lot. We've got quite strong leadership. We have 9 iwi Māori organisations across Aorihi who are part of the Whānau Order Alliance. So we have quite a wide spread across that particular area from the out to Palmerston North, out to Manawatū, out to the Valley, and then down to Whenua as well. So it's quite a, you know, a large area of iwi Māori organisations who are also predominantly that we're your health and social service provider organisations. Plus, we also have Māori organisations, arms of those, the Māori Women's Welfare League and Aokau Māori Wardens. We have hapu also represented in that space. So we have quite a large, we have iwi that have settled within our alliance, as well as those that are still going through that process. So, you know, we are affected by the bureaucracy and the government process and policy, but in quite a number of different ways.
Yeah. Wow. So I'm getting this picture of a real diversity of your region, of the people who you're serving, lots of cooks in the kitchen, if you will. And you were talking as well about that balance between forgiveness and permission in your relationship with your te tiriti partners. Like, what, how do you even manage that? You know, how do you decide, okay, this is a situation where we're just going to do it, and this is a situation where we're going to sit back and wait? Like, what's going on for you there?
It is a balance, but it is about, you know, always at the forefront is how do we improve outcomes for our whānau and for our people. And, you know, sometimes it does just require a little bit of a push and, you know, how are we going to do that? Relationships are absolutely key. They're just so, you know, having relationships, having good relationships, but also being able to stand your ground in those relationships. Yeah. And that it isn't, as our upoko whakarai or CEO often says, you know, it's been a master-servant relationship for such a long time and we need to move out of that mindset. And how are we, you know, going to advocate and drive forward for our whānau? And that's where those, you know, relationships are key. They also impart knowledge through those relationships. Sometimes there are some very knowledgeable people in that government space who are only too willing to help and assist to remove those systemic barriers that you can often face.
Yeah. And Vanessa, you're touching on one of the four key insights of the report. And so what I might just do here for people listening, who probably, let's face it, are on the train or the bus, they don't have the report in their hand, but there's kind of four insights that you pulled out of a whole series of discussions with people working in management positions in government, with people working in iwi organizations, community organizations, kind of all different perspectives in the system. And I'm going to jump to the third one of the insights, which you were just touching on there, Vanessa, which was creating the conditions for ethical and trusting relationships. And so I think also, you know, the other thing to mention here is the overall shift that Inspiring Communities is encouraging in this report, which is not just public policy looking at, okay, what are the solutions that we're going to create and choose for communities? But also thinking about how do we create the conditions for community-led responses. So that's kind of the whole framing of the report. But this third insight around creating the conditions for ethical and trusting relationships. Sarah, I'm curious for you, what did you learn through the report writing process that was new or interesting for you in that space?
Oh, gosh. I mean, how we kind of did this was we went to eight, I call them change makers, so people who sit sort of between or have at some point in time worked in government or in community or both or somewhere in the middle, sort of those in-betweeners that I said I gravitated towards.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess they all spoke to that. So then we, you know, we had conversations with these people and then sort of drew out what were some commonalities or themes. And it always comes back to relationships, doesn't it? Yeah. I mean, everything does. We're humans, we're social animals. It always comes back to relationships. And I suppose there's also some recent study that I've been involved in around what does it look like to sort of ethically orient to relationship? And I guess from a te tiriti perspective, what that looks like for me or where I've got to is that te tiriti or waitangi provides that base for understanding who tangata whenua are as Indigenous peoples and who everybody else who has a right to belong in Aotearoa is manuhiri, is tangata tiriti. And so for me, it kind of goes back to the reason I mentioned that is that that was a strong theme that came through around these ethical and trusting relationships. It kind of goes back to that foundation and who you are as a person, you know, Kawaio, it's a great way to open our kōrero today. Who are you? How do you belong here? So you have a right to be here under te tiriti, but what responsibilities do you have and what value do you offer to your community? Mm-hmm. So I guess entering into any relationship with someone, be it at the community level, be it in business, be it wherever, that sort of ethic of trust and reciprocity going into that relationship is something that we heard from a lot of the stories that were shared with us. So it wasn't always about ethnicity or race relations, but it was about what the kaupapa is and who, where do you belong and who are you serving, I suppose.
Yeah, interesting. And I think, you know, if we look backwards, there's probably been a strong emphasis within government, particularly on technical knowledge, expertise and understanding in the public policy process. And I'm nodding as you're talking there, Sarah, but one thing I've found hard is when you're working with people who maybe aren't coming in with that understanding of the importance of relationships, the need for investing in that, spending time on that. Vanessa, I'm wondering if you've encountered that kind of challenge yourself and what you've learned about working with people come in with a different preconception there.
Yeah, it's not unusual.
It's not just me, right?
No, no, it's not just you. No, but I think it does require, you know, a good dose of patience. I think it also, you know, we operate from a premise of aroha, tika, and pono. And if you keep those close and actually behave in the way you speak, that it is about being respectful to others, of going there with graciousness and aroha, and being true, being transparent and your reasons, your purposes for being. And I suppose that's where the reciprocity in it. You know, I heard you say, yeah, the reciprocity that you expect that the person on the other side of the table or the other side of the Zoom is actually going to behave in that same way with you. And I think in general, people do. And sometimes the rub comes from misunderstanding. And it's about, I think, is about the willingness to understand another point of view when you're, you know, it's like the terms of engagement. Everybody needs to have the same understanding of what those terms of engagement are to have a robust conversation that is, you know, seeking some really positive outcomes as a result of those relationships.
Yeah. And I wonder if it also comes from sometimes a resourcing imbalance, again, going to the kind of the technical and the human side of working together. I loved the lesson from Sarah Yarrow that was in the report. I forget the organization she was representing, but she spoke about a lesson being that for every technical person who works in our organization, actually we need a human focused or person focused person. And that she sees and hears communities just calling out for somebody who can support the social process that brings people together to make it all happen. Sarah, you're smiling, you're nodding. What resonates so strongly for you?
Yeah, I think I enjoyed talking to a fellow Sarah about that too. So she was working, I think is still working for the Living Waters Partnership between Fonterra and DOC, which I think was a super interesting kind of case study to talk about. Yeah, and she talked about that idea of having social coaches and how in organisations that were steeped in, so that the kaupapa for them is about waterways, like cleaning up waterways. And so she did use that story about, you know, it's easy for government to fund, well, maybe not easy, but it's what they're used to funding is around technical sort of outputs. You know, if you're talking about agriculture or, you know, fertilizers or whatever it is, but it's that sort of, yeah, that social stuff that's
the glue.
The glue is yeah, I think that's what she talked about, and about how one of the recommendations in the report, or one of the ways to apply the learning, I should say, is about how to resource those people in those processes that take time, but you end up with a more enduring kind of result when you're invested in those relationships at the start. But it's also about measuring that as an outcome. So, you know, that process stuff. And I think that's something that I've noticed in government circles or in NGO circles or whatever, is that we don't at the start plan for how we're going to measure the outcome of, you can have all these relationships and agreements with people, with iwi, with hapu, with community organizations, but what is the quality of those relationships? What are the outcomes of them? And, you know, if you were to ask people in community, oh, wow, you've got this relationship agreement with government, but if you actually ask them, what does that look like for you? How's that going? You know, you might get a different answer. So I think some way of, there was also a lesson in there around what you measure. And I think that's a really interesting exercise. And I'm not a data person. It's much easier to count widgets than it is to sort of talk to people about their emotions and, you know, how they're feeling about how things are going. but I wonder if there's something in there around how we might try and do that better.
Well, Sarah, I'm not a data person either, so we can leave that to our colleagues who love that stuff, because it's so important to be able to put a different measure on what has happened. Hey, I'm aware of time. I reckon we could just spend the rest of the time talking about that insight. But let's jump to another one. Vanessa, should we go 1, 2, or 4?
1, 2, or 4? You take your pick. It feels like motto. Oh, look, I think, yeah, well, I can probably talk across the three of them, to be honest.
Let's start back up the top, which was around creating the conditions for Te Ao Māori-led change. And yeah, one thing that I was really interested to read in the report, which came from you, was about how iwi Māori had stood up systems and processes really quickly. Wow, in, you know, COVID, some of our recent natural disasters have shined a light on what has been going on for a long time, but maybe hasn't been as visible to government or to other people not working in iwi Māori spaces. And that sometimes those stories aren't captured by the government, they can't quite seen or understood, and the recognition isn't there. And so, yeah, I'm really interested in what that experience has been like for you on the ground.
I think, you know, it's so right. For COVID is our first, I suppose, visual experience of iwi and Māori just really standing up straight away was, you know, we've been doing that for a long time. And I think because COVID was such a big kaupapa across not only the country, but across the world, you know, there was a lot of intense spotlight in a time of real uncertainty. And, you know, people were frightened about how we're going to do that. This was a bit of that, an example of the not waiting for permission. Iwi Māori around the country got on and did, because we knew that our whānau were isolated overnight. They were, you know, everyone was suddenly home. You couldn't do this. You couldn't do that. People were frightened. And we couldn't wait for, you know, government to decide, have a bit of a hoi, decide what they were doing, release resources. And you would have seen a lot of the iwi Māori actually dipped into their own resources to activate response during that time. And people were repurposed. They were, you know, doing all sorts of things they might not have done in their day job prior to COVID. And that went on for a long period of time. You know, you saw people, vaccination centers, distribution centers, you know, there was a whole lot going on, and that may not have been everybody's daily jobs that they were doing at that time. And I think that's when you really saw iwi Māori stand up. And I think one of those pieces upon reflection that many iwi Māori, I don't think iwi Māori got the recognition that was due for their ability to respond with such swiftness and appropriateness, using their own resources while we waited for government to kind of hustle along. Yeah, but I don't think my iwi Māori are waiting for that either so much. We knew something had to be done, the recent floods.
Yeah.
Again, you see that, but with working with communities, you know, standing up really quickly, getting what you needed, and those unaffected areas being ready, sending people, sending kai, sending resources to those spaces that they became so overwhelmed with things as well.
And, you know, when we're talking about creating the conditions for Te Ao Māori-led change, you've just been talking about those crisis points where there's an immediate disaster or crisis, and then, you know, Māori-led responses. What do you see as the need in terms of creating the conditions when we're not in that immediate crisis point?
Yeah, I think that's where we are about being assertive, being courageous, being, this is actually what we need, and this is how we need it, and when we need it. And if you're not, you know, I did say to Rachel one time, you know, it's like, people get out of the way if you're not ready to actually change practice or change. And it's about, I think, that's where the relationships don't come in, though. You're on a daily basis piece. That is where the relationships come in, about how do we access that particular resource, that particular line of funding, but also how do we find innovative ways to create our own funding, our own ways of being, where we aren't then accountable. Not accountable is not the right word, because I think iwi Māori are always accountable over and above many other organizations. The expectations are huge. But I think it's also about establishing, like I know you said about data before, but that data of the widgets and the narrative, though, we figure so prominently in every deficit data that you can find. And so one is acknowledging, okay, that's a thing, but not getting so stuck in that, that we don't actually make any difference. We don't be innovative. We don't try to find other ways to meet the needs of our whānau so that we are improving those outcomes for people. You know, otherwise we'll just get stuck on wallowing around in all the negative and the deficit. What's the point in that? You know, it's like, it's a whole waste of energy in that space.
Yeah, it feels very different when you start from another space that is more around possibilities and relationships.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the reality is for a lot of people that possibility space has just felt inaccessible in the last couple of years because of things that have been going on. And I guess that's what this report is about, is actually, yes, we're working in the system, but we also need to work on it and make it easier for ourselves when the next crisis hits.
Well, I think it is, just to sort of add that, Paul, it's not just, you know, we can change service delivery. We can change what happens when you walk in the door.
Yeah.
But, you know, we need to be changing at policy and system and legislation levels for if we want sustainable change, not just change for a term or for a finite period. We actually need to be able to influence those other systemic barriers and remove those and replace them with something much better. You know, and we saw a lot of those barriers being dropped during that COVID. And, you know, after we said, oh, well, we're back to business as usual. And a lot of people said, why? Why? That didn't work. This did work. So, you know, there it was, I suppose, evidence that actually we can do things differently at a systems level if those, you know, if we choose to do that.
And this for me is where the connection comes into the fourth insight from the report, which is around creating the conditions for innovation, learning, and adaptability. And I really enjoyed reading the example from, I might have the pronunciation wrong here, so you can correct me, Gandhi Nivas, which talked about a policy development process that started bottom up. So yeah, the usual way, and this was my first job, was in the Ministry of Justice, sitting around, not knowing very much about the communities that I was serving, not knowing very much about the subject matter because I was fresh out of university, and trying to devise this best policy in isolation. Whereas, you know, Gandhi Nivas and what was talked about in the report is actually starting the other way around and going to communities and going, what's working here on the ground? Okay, how do we bring that up into the policy response? Sarah, again, you're doing your head nod thing here.
I'm just like, preach, Paul, preach.
Yeah, do you want to add on to that?
I think that was a great case study. And the other one that I'm thinking about is the one from Anna Jane Edwards around up-tempo. And about it kind of speaks to the idea, the overall insight of the report where the policy, you know, we talk about the system, what we're really talking, systems are people who, you know, operate in different ways. And I think what up-tempo showed in a quite practical way was how a government agency had actually chosen to take more of a role as a facilitator or as a conduit, to use the words that we use in the report, of kind of ideas and relationships and playing a convening role in order to respond in ways that were open and adaptable to what communities were saying were their needs and their aspirations. So it's the same as the Gandhi Nevis example, really, where it's coming from community because community knows what they need and what works. It's not, you know, so the idea that government and policy people, as you say, Paul, I've been in those situations. I came from an international development background where, you know, where you're going into places and teaching them how to do things, which makes no sense.
Yeah.
And so it's actually reversing that role. So I do think there is a place for government. And the COVID response is a really good example of, you know, ways that government were able to kind of do things at scale. But I don't think that the way that the public policy process has been working is the future. I think things need to change. And I think part of that is a bit of a mindset shift to recasting that kind of role of government as facilitators, conveners, learners, and community having that decision-making control. And yeah, so it's sort of flipping that paradigm that I think that people have been used to. And it's starting to happen naturally anyway, because there is no sort of one source of truth and control anymore.
Yeah.
And our problems are complex, and you know, there's a cluster of things going on. Government just actually can't keep up. Bureaucracy can't keep up. And so, you know, our rangatahi are seeing the world differently and kind of just getting on with it. Mm-hmm. And I think, yeah, these old institutions that have come from a long time ago, they're just not the way forward. So to jump around between the insights as well, I just, before we move on from the Te Ao Māori one, I think there's a lot of gold. That's funny. I said gold there, and then I was thinking, but we can't extract it. So, you know, it can't be an extractive process. But I think those concepts around intergenerational well-being, around collective well-being, around centering nature, all of those Indigenous concepts starting to be noticed by non-Indigenous people as the way forward, you know. So we said, oh, these are new concepts. And, you know, Indigenous people were like, nah, that's just how we roll. So I think public policy is needing to catch up.
Yeah. I've been in conversations with Māori friends and colleagues where they're sort of going, how far should we push it with this group of people? How much do we bring in our Indigenous wisdom here? We don't want to scare them and make them run away. And we need to stay true and strong to that mātauranga, that knowledge that we have. Which is an interesting, again, Vanessa, like coming back to that dance between permission and forgiveness that you're always playing.
Yeah, I think institutional racism is alive and well. You know, we kind of maybe sometimes skirt around that and pretend that it's not a thing, but it is. It's alive and well and experienced by many of us across the country. I think, you know, just in terms of that Māori led, that mātauranga Māori, I know we've just, you know, recently done a lot of engagement with our whānau across the Rōpē, and that really strong message, I think it's intensifying about the, you know, the valuing of mātauranga Māori and rongoā, whether that's, you know, through plants, whether it's through healing in some other way. But that's becoming a Māori differently, like we, you know, just go the resources over, let those resources loose, because what you're doing at the moment doesn't have as much success as we know that we can get if we are able to do this in our way. And I think, you know, there is, in terms of the government, we're kind of working alongside the social sector commissioning space that is opening up. We've had Whānau Water Commissioning Agency who do a damn good job with that commissioning model. You know, it's actually, we're achieving outcomes that far exceed when we're on a tight, rigid contract that counts widgets, or how many people did you pick? Well, actually, how many people did we influence for change across generations? If we were using a whānau water lens and a whānau water approach, you know, that not so much measuring outcomes, but what are we looking for? What does the outcome look like? You know, is it numbers? Is it actually, well, I, you know, there's much improved. There's something that you can now see change two generations along. You know, redefining our ability to redefine what those outcomes are and the pathways that we move along to achieve those. That's important. You know, that's really where we see the change. It's not all the low-hanging fruit of we got 10 Māori to stop smoking, but they're now vaping. I don't know. For, you know, that stop counting the widgets and think about the broader outcomes we can achieve with our approaches through that whānau water lens and that mātauranga Māori valuing of that.
And what have you seen, Vanessa, because you're talking there about being flexible as you go along to change what are the outcomes you're looking for, being flexible as you go along about how you work together. What is it at the start or during that has enabled that and made that easier to have that flexibility?
I think whānau voice is so crucial.
Yeah.
You know, whānau hapuri. You know, Sarah said that, you know, the answers lie within our people, whether it's in their homes, in their communities, and having the belief and having that wisdom to support whānau and hapori to identify what is it that success looks like for you as a whānau? What does that look like? And then what is it that we need to do? What are the resources we need to access in order to make that happen? As opposed to, here's a really cool program developed in an office somewhere and we'll just roll it out across the country and then wondering, why is it not hitting in that particular community? Why is it not taking in that community? Because if people, if that maybe wasn't relevant for them before they got rolled out across the country. So I think, you know, that whānau voice, that community voice is so very important to what are the levers we're looking for? Where are we looking to unlock those resources?
One of the things that I wonder about, if this is what keeps people stuck in that idea of we develop the program and then we roll it out, is people looking for scale and efficiency.
Mm.
And so, yeah, well, how do you respond to that need that people have, which is a valid need? It's being smart with your money. How do you respond to that?
I think, you know, we just can't have that one size fits all, which is really predominantly how you get the scale and efficiencies from a particular angle. You know, and it's easier to do the cookie cutter response, but it may need a more tailored and customized response in each of those different, I mean, even across Aotearoa line, we have so many different communities. Mm. And approach has been about, well, what works in that community? What is going to work there? You know, what works in Palmerston North say isn't going to work out the back of, you know, coastal there. It's just not. It's trying to go, okay, what are some of those elements that are consistent across so that we know we have a consistent approach. We don't have a scattergun approach to our people. You know, if they come to us, they know they can expect these things when they're engaging with us. But there's also that ability to be flexible, to customize, to respond to localized solutions, to localize, you know, what people are asking for at that space. And it's doable. It doesn't have to be one or the other. It can be an end-to-end situation.
I was just going to say exactly that, Vanessa, though. I was going to say it's an end-to-end. So I think there are situations where, you know, national scaled approaches might be relevant and appropriate. And I think it is about creating those conditions for localized approaches that make sense in community. So it can be both. And I think if you really prioritize that kind of adaptability, flexibility, and sharing learning, so, you know, in Vanessa's community, you know, something might work. They might share it with the community down the road and they might pick up one idea from that, but drop the other two because that's not going to work for them. You know, all of that kind of learning, open, collaborative, sharing what works, I think, is the way forward. And so that's that idea of it's a decentralized model of government, I suppose, what we're talking about is getting that money out to where it's needed and having the trusting relationships to know that that's going to be more enduring and more successful for people.
I'm interested in that word decentralized because I have an assumption that some people might run from that and go, "Ooh, that sounds a bit much for me." But I've also heard recently the phrase locally led, regionally supported, and nationally enabled, which I've found helpful because it then says, yeah, decentralized almost makes it as if, well, there's nothing for the national level people to do, which isn't true.
That
actually gives a little bit more a clear labeling about this is where you sit. This is what your role is.
Mm.
Which I think comes to our, was it number two? I don't know. I've lost track of what our, it's number two, which the second insight, which was around repositioning policy workers as conduits and facilitators. And so here I'm guessing this is the shift from, okay, I'm in government, therefore I'm the doer. I need to figure out what the solution is. We need to create it and we need to roll it out. To, okay, I'm in government, so my role is to enable and help others to be able to achieve that. Sarah, can you explain in your words what this one was about?
I think you did a stellar job, Paul. But it is that, yeah, being a conduit of funds, resources, and a facilitator of kind of ideas and relationships. I think that's really what that one is all about. And it is sort of we talk about it as a recasting because I think, you know, it's not that we're suggesting that, you know, really smart people who work in government on policy, that they can't use their skills and that it has to be all just the community. I think community people don't want to be writing policies. That's not, you know, that's not what they want to be doing. But if you've got that system, as you said before, where you've got the respectful relationships, you know who people are in community and what relationships they hold. So you don't take over their relationships, but you respect the relationships that they have. And I think that's also that they have with the resources in their community and nature, you know, how it all, I don't know, I don't like the term natural resources, but thinking about it from that perspective as well, that government has a role, but there's so much around. And I'm coming back, I suppose, to the institutional racism point that you made, Vanessa, as well, around land and around who owns the land, but also who mana whenua are in that place and what land means to them. So, yeah.
In terms of government and the conduit space. And, you know, I think that is about everybody having a role, like we've spoken about, because there are some really knowledgeable people who have a really thorough understanding of the machinations of government. And whether we like it or not, you know, that's up front and center when we're talking about much of the resource that we try to access, work alongside. And I do think, you know, there's also the ability from communities to really influence change within that central government space. And I think that's why I say, you know, we do value those relationships. Sometimes they're not fabulous, and sometimes they take a lot of hard work. But at the same time, we don't necessarily want to know what all the machinations of government are, but we do want to have the relationships with the people who are absolutely amazing at that and who carry that knowledge. So I do, think that everybody has a role. You know, they obviously, the bold or the Pooty are out to us would be fine. You know, we might bring some of those people who would love to be back in the community. But there's also some people who love what they do and they're very good at it. And having a relationship with them for the right reasons is quite important in terms of unlocking resources. So the flow of those resources comes out to communities so we can actually do what our people are saying they need done.
Yeah, and I'm wondering how much of the status quo is kept in place by fear or worry about a whole bunch of things, but some of them being, well, if we give over resource and power, then, you know, it'll all turn to custard.
And we'll turn to custard and quickly, and oh, goodness, they will never know what to do.
But and maybe a bit of fear and worry that if we give over power and resource, well, what will I do? What will we do? Yeah. Which I think is important to name, because then you can work through it, which is some of what the conversation is in this report, really.
Yeah, I'm glad that you brought that up, Paul, because I think it is, the report is really pitched at, you know, when we started thinking about it, we're thinking it's pitched at kind of managers, policy managers and operational managers in government. And because systems are made up of people and we know that those people are doing a good job, they're often overworked, they're working in these short-term political cycles, they're, you know, there is a lot of fear. I've worked in government. It can be a really toxic kind of environment where you're just sort of pushing bits of paper around and stressing out all the time. So I think there is a lot of that. And so what I think, you know, there does need to be an element of courage and pushback against these timeframes and against these demands. And that's really hard because people also have jobs and they want to pay their bills. And, you know, what will they do if they leave government, particularly if they live in Pōneke and Wellington? You know, that's where a lot of the work is. So I think it's just, that's why we talk about the word, we use the word shift, because I think it's how can, you know, we know that, you know, there's an element of we need to burn it all down and start again because the system doesn't work. You know, that sort of revolution. But I think there's also these quiet revolutions that we can take when we have the power to manage a team. Are we doing that in a way that's positive and relational? And are we letting people who work in government who have these talents and skills really, you know, be able to fulfill their potential? And to, because everybody's a member of a community somewhere. Everyone's got whānau. Everyone wants, you know, we all, you know, mostly I think we want good outcomes for people and places, but it's how we get there. And I hope that the report, it's framed in sort of a strengths-based way. And I think, Vanessa, to your point, you know, there are good people everywhere. It's just about having that courage to maybe change one little thing next week. You know, what are you going to do? And there's some really practical ideas in there about how people might be able to bring their teams along on that journey.
Yeah, I love that element of the report, actually. So I'd really encourage people who are listening, go have a look, because there are, you know, not checklists, because it's not a do this and then you're done, but more a list of considerations. If you were to put this insight around creating the conditions for ethical and trusting relationships into place, here are a bunch of things you can consider. And they're really practical and achievable, which is nice, because sometimes this conversation, the stuff that we're talking about, can just sound a bit airy-fairy, and you go, oh, yeah, that's nice. Someone else can do that. But what change can I make? And the report actually says, well, this is the change you can make, which I found really refreshing and inspiring. Yeah.
Awesome. Oh.
Hey, well, look, thank you so much, Vanessa. Thank you, Sarah. I really enjoyed jumping around the report with you and pulling out some stories and some insights. So any final things that you'd like to share? Vanessa, I'll pass the rako to you first.
That's always that, you know, that last gem of wisdom you try to find. Yeah, I think it's, you know, the report, that the ability to shift that mana and that power and that mātauranga back to for us iwi Māori, in order to actualize those aspirations that our whānau express and share and hold very dearly. I think that's the piece about working together to be able to achieve that as an outcome is pretty awesome.
Kia ora, Vanessa. And Sarah?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I think what I would like to end with is just the idea that everyone actually can make a difference. As cheesy as it sounds, you know, what small thing can you do to change the way that you fulfilling your role in government? This does have a focus on public sector, but it's the relationship between the public sector and communities. And yeah, I just, nobody wants to write reports that people don't read and use. So I hope it's written in a way that's accessible and that there might be some ideas in there for someone.
Kia ora kōrua.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Beyond Consultation. And what now? Well, I've got three suggestions for you. Firstly, go and check out the show notes in your podcast player or on the Business Lab or Learning Lab website so you can see the resources that were shared in the show. Secondly, send a message to our guests. It's really nice when you've been a guest in this slightly nerve-wracking experience and then people get in touch to thank you for sharing your stories and experiences. And lastly, do connect with me on LinkedIn. I view LinkedIn as an ongoing conference, you know, this amazing way to be exposed to new people and new ideas that can stretch and enhance your practice. So that's it for today's episode. Thank you again for listening. Ngā mihi mō te whakaro.